And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Portland City Council will vote on a land swap for the Steel Bridge Skate Park. Oregon lawmakers consider changes to how childhood education funding is structured. And Multnomah County's budget shortfall is not as bad as previously estimated, potentially averting the need for layoffs. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, March 18, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. The dream of a skate park under the Steel Bridge could be one step closer to reality after the Portland City Council meeting on Wednesday evening. The council will vote to exchange property with the Oregon Department of Transportation to combine with existing city property to make up the footprint of the skate park. City funds have already been allocated to help build the park under the Steel Bridge in Old Town. Supporters of the skate park say it could be a real landmark destination for skaters and for tourists. Plans for the skate park include areas that engage multiple different ages and skill levels. It would offer a competition-level bowl, but also areas geared more towards children and beginners. The skate park would have some areas covered by the bridge and nearby on-ramps, meaning more of the park could be used during rainier parts of the year. The council first heard the resolution on March 5th, and here's what District 4 Councilor Eric Zimmerman, Olivia Clark, and Mitch Green had to say about it.
Thanks. I put my hand up in the queue to hopefully set a tone as the district council for this area. I am fully supportive of this swap. I am fully appreciative of all the staff and advocates and neighbors who've been involved in this. I know absolutely nothing about skateboarding, and I think this is a testament. You can be supportive for cool stuff that you know nothing about, right? And when I think about Old Town, I've said it before, I think it's ground zero for so many of our other issues. And when you are at the north part of Waterfront Park, it feels like you are a mile away from Lansu Chinese Garden, given how difficult this area of our community is just to get from one part of a neighborhood to another. It's been the subject of so many challenges over the years that this is an exciting swap and an important step toward, I think, a real solution, something that's innovative and something that the neighborhood needs significantly.
This is even more shocking than learning that our Councilor Zimmerman doesn't use a skateboard. I don't either. Never been on one. Watched my brother skateboard a lot. But what I wanted to say is that this is a classic example of intergovernmental coordination, and I'm all about that. I'm a real nerd for intergovernmental relations and making these things work. And thanks to everybody. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you all for making this happen. I'll just echo what Councilman Zimmerman said, is that this is really important to activate this part of Old Town, the far north part of Old Town. I'm really looking forward to that activation and what it can do for more than just the skateboarders, for really everybody in the area and citywide.
I'm going to start by saying I praise the staff work that went into this. I think we're in this moment now where voters are like, what the heck's going on at the city? What's going on in our levels of government? And this is a really good example of sort of identifying constraints and working to clear those in a very sensible way that rationalizes a problem. So keep that up, and that's a model. We're talking about downtown activation. We're hearing from community members who are saying, you know, there's no reason for us to come downtown with my children. My children don't feel safe. Bring your children and teach them how to skateboard. We have, Girls Skate Like a Girl, I think, is the organization that's on there. They do great work. It's very accessible, and that's what the skate park's going to be. I'll note that I am a skater, but not a very good one. Okay, I had my career stunted when I moved to a gravel road at the age of 13, so you know, it doesn't work out. But I have fond memories of hanging out at the Burnside Bridge and just observing, trying to learn to skate, and feeling like a certain level of mentorship that you get from older people in the community and learning how to behave and conduct yourself. And I think that's part of the skater community.
That was Portland City Councilors Eric Zimmerman, Olivia Clark, and Mitch Green speaking about the resolution at its first meeting on March 5th. The property transfer on Wednesday's City Council agenda has been in the works for over 20 years, And if it passes, the construction and management of the park will go to Parks and Rec to get it off the ground. Wednesday's City Council meeting will be at 6 p.m. at City Hall and live streamed on the city's YouTube page. A bill aimed at modernizing the way Oregon funds early childhood special education has passed through the State House with near unanimous support. Early childhood advocates say that it will support children with disabilities as well as their families and educators. Isabel Charlet has the details.
Legislation that would overhaul the way Oregon funds early childhood special education has advanced through the State House with near unanimous support, moving to the Senate Education Committee. House Bill 2682 would create an advisory committee to recommend service updates incorporating the latest research and family experiences. Representative Courtney Neron, a Democrat from Wilsonville, is sponsoring the bill. She says the current funding model no longer reflects the reality of what it takes to support young children with disabilities, and this bill would set the state up for success.
This prepares us to know exactly what needs to change in our early intervention, early childhood special education to make sure that we are taking appropriate legislative next steps.
Neron highlights the need to update the timing of special education funding, which is currently allocated in the spring. She notes that programs often grow by 40% during the school year, leaving staff overwhelmed with caseloads in the second half. Stacey Rager with the Northwest Regional Education Service District says Oregon needs a new funding model to ensure children receive more instructional time, closer to the 30 hours of preschool per week offered by other states. She says students in Oregon sometimes get as few as 4 hours of special ed services per week.
I have had many tearful conversations with families where they move in from a different part of the country, and I have to deliver the sad news that we just are not funded at that level.
Rager hopes to stabilize special ed funding, which has been experiencing large swings over the years, to prevent staff cuts that directly impact families. Her team includes special ed teachers, occupational therapists, and speech pathologists.
Finding people that want to do this work, that have a heart for this work, and then to have to hire and lay off, it's just so hard on the staff and on the families.
She adds that with adequate funding, her program can extend its services inside preschools, offering additional adult support and training for preschool staff. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Multnomah County's budget shortfall is not as bad as previously reported. A new prediction from the county says there's just a $15 million shortfall, down from over $21 million. Officials say that means it's less likely that the county would need to do layoffs to make up the difference. The county expects an increase in business income tax and motor vehicle tax, and that will help close some of the gap. There are still big cuts in the works, which the county has to figure out before the end of the fiscal year in July. Economist Jeff Renfro warned that instability in the federal government could take an economic toll on the county government too, even though their total budget is around $4 billion. Layoffs negatively impact tax revenue for the county, and tariffs could make projects that are in the works more expensive. Multnomah County isn't the only local government dealing with budget shortfalls. Portland has a significant shortfall, and so does Washington County. Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Pedersen will recommend her budget at the end of April for commissioners to work on finalizing. Tacoma's Northwest Ice Processing Center has been plagued by reports of human rights violations and lawsuits for years. On the year anniversary of the death of a migrant, legislators and immigrant rights advocates continue to push for the center's closure amid increased activity. Isabel Charlet has the story. The Trump administration fights a court order on deportation flights, as lawyers say the government is overreaching on expelling migrants. And NOAA cuts could spell trouble for those concerned about weather emergencies. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. The president, through proclamation, took his authority under Alien Enemies Act and imposed it, which he has the right to do. TDA has been designated a terrorist organization. TDA is an enemy in this country.
Border Czar Tom Homan agrees with President Donald Trump's decision to invoke the Alien Enemies Act to deport what they say are Venezuelan gang members. In a weekend proclamation, Trump moved to deport 200 Venezuelan immigrants to El Salvador, accusing them of being in the Tren de Aragua gang. But the White House offered no proof of gang membership, and family members have disputed any connection. The proclamation was quickly challenged by a federal court order, but the deportations didn't stop in time. The judge called for the planes to be turned around, but the administration and the government of El Salvador said they didn't get word until the migrants had left U.S. airspace. Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller says the judge's order was ill-informed and says they will fight it.
The judge, which is truly beyond comprehension and belief, issued his unlawful order without even receiving any information on this terrorist organization, on the diplomacy that had been conducted internationally by the Secretary of State, any briefing from the intelligence community.
The Alien Enemies Act has only been used 3 times previously, all during a war declared by Congress. But Trump says the nation is at war, calling the influx of migrants an invasion. He also accuses the gang of organized fentanyl trafficking, but data shows native-born Americans coming through legal ports of entry bring a majority of the drug into the country. Advocates say any migrant accused of being associated with TDA could be deported without proof or due process. ACLU attorney Lee Gallant says the government knowingly violated the court order by allowing the flights to leave, and he says a court hearing would give people a chance to prove the president's executive order shouldn't apply to them.
If a person does not believe they're a member of the gang, can show that, and they're not subject to the proclamation, yet the administration has not only invoked the act in an unprecedented and lawless way, but they have refused to give individuals the opportunity to show that they're not actually part of the gang.
Gallant says Congress was explicit, saying the Alien Enemies Act can only be used against a foreign government that has invaded or is waging war against the U.S. Alina Haba, a counselor to Trump, says rogue judges are trying to stand in the way of an executive decision. Given that rhetoric and similar administration comments, legal observers say they see a possible crisis brewing in the conflict between 2 of the 3 branches of government.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. On today's episode, updating Oregon's tax code, a local Portland florist, and the upcoming Spring Whale Watch Week on the Oregon coast. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 53. Today in history, in 1990, the largest art theft in U.S. history takes place at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. 12 paintings, collectively worth around $500 million, were stolen. The quote of the day is from American writer John Updike, who said, quote, "Man is an animal, but a social animal. Society, for its manifold blessings, asks in exchange sacrifice and compromise. Concession is the world's walking gate. Fevers and hallucinations sweep over us, it is true, but be they permitted to infect the public body, slaughter shall result. Government is either organized benevolence or organized madness. Its peculiar magnitude permits no shading." A project to bring solar power to the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming is on hold because of Trump's federal funding freezes. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A project bringing solar energy to the Wind River Reservation has hit some road bumps due to pauses in federal funding. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports, the team searching for other ways to move forward.
Energize Wind River is poised to set up standalone solar systems and bring electricity to roughly 40 Eastern Shoshone homes. But
the but would be that our construction funding is currently on hold pending review.
That's project director Levi Purdom. He says about $2 million of funding is paused. Even though the project has funding for training, employees, and outreach, it's unable to buy or install the solar equipment. Purdom is optimistic that the funding will eventually come through. But for now, the group secured a $20,000 grant from the Nature Conservancy.
They wanted to support our non-governmental fundraising efforts. So the intent is to hire and fund a fundraising specialist.
Energize Wind River still plans to start construction this spring if they're able to raise enough money. Other tribal nations across the Mountain West are facing similar issues amid budget cuts by the Trump administration. I'm Hannah Haberman.
Marine species like salmon and humpback whales might be becoming more frequent fixtures in the Arctic, especially as sea ice becomes less reliable from climate change. For residents in Alaska's most northern communities, it can mean changes to subsistence. The shifts in migration are also fascinating scientists. KNBA's Alaska Desk reporter Alona Nyden has more.
Catching salmon in the North Slope village of Kaktovik was unheard of not too long ago. But as resident Robert Thompson says, some fishermen now see salmon more regularly. About 5 years ago, Thompson caught a dozen salmon, a small but noticeable number, he says.
Before it was unusual and people would talk about it, but somebody got a salmon, but now it's fairly common.
Fishermen, hunters, and researchers gathered at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium in Anchorage back in January to discuss changing migration patterns of several fish species and marine animals. One of the conference presenters was Elizabeth Mika-Clindley, a graduate student from Bethel who grew up fishing for salmon. For a year, Lindley and other researchers tracked temperatures in the Anaktuvik River, which runs through gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve.
The temperature conditions, it seems like they are survivable.
Less ice might also mean new territory for humpback whales. Oceanographer Kate Stafford says data from local whalers and aerial surveys points to more humpbacks visiting the Chukchi Sea in recent years. In Utqiagvik, humpbacks were sighted only twice before 2021 and 2 to 3 times in years after that. Then, last fall, researchers saw more than 25 whales feeding close together for 2 days in a row.
We came across what I would call humpback palooza.
Utqiagvik whaler Michael Donovan says he did not witness the humpback palooza, but he has seen a few humpbacks during his fall hunts. He says that he and other whalers are worried that humpbacks might be competing for krill and copepods with bowheads, the staple subsistence resource in his community.
Well, definitely they're an invasive species. You know, they come in and eat the same food that our bowheads eat.
Donovan and other hunters say they're supportive of scientists collecting data on whales other than bowheads, which are growing their presence in warming waters in the Arctic. In Anchorage, I am Alona Nyden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto needs at amerind.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
After sending his documentary, Climate Refugees, to the moon in 2024, Florida-born filmmaker Michael Nash is now on a new mission, getting the faces of climate refugees featured on postage stamps. The film, which highlights the human impact of climate-driven migration, has screened globally and inspired lunar artwork. Nash aims to keep these urgent stories visible, advocating for those displaced by climate change. Tramell Gomes has more on the story.
Last year, filmmaker Michael Nash achieved the extraordinary when his documentary, Climate Refugees, was sent to the moon as part of a lunar museum project. Now he's on a new mission, getting the faces of climate refugees featured on postage stamps to keep the conversation about climate migration alive. Climate Refugees, which premiered at Sundance and was later featured on Netflix, has been a powerful tool for raising awareness about the human impact of climate change. Nash and his team traveled to 48 countries, uncovering stories of forced migration driven by droughts, food shortages, and environmental collapse.
And what we found was this intersection in civilization where overpopulation, overconsumption, lack of resources, and a changing climate were slamming into each other. And the outcome of that was forced migration because people were running out of water and food in places that they once, where they lived for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
While the film's journey to the moon in 2024 was a historic milestone, Nash is now focused on a more down-to-earth goal, creating postage stamps featuring the faces of climate refugees. Although gaining approval from the U.S. Postal Service's Stamp Committee will require demonstrating the issue's national relevance and historical significance. Despite the progress in raising awareness, Nash emphasizes that the world has not done enough to address climate migration.
The truth still lies in that there is not an international law accepted by all countries that are going to give asylum or protection to these people who are forced to relocate due to climate change.
According to the United Nations, more than 20 million people are displaced annually by climate-related events, making the need for action more pressing than ever. Nash was a featured speaker at last week's Climate Correction Conference in Orlando. His next project, a film exploring the intersection of artificial intelligence and climate change, is currently in production and set for release in 2026. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
Now we go to Global Citizen Commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says Trump's America First foreign policy agenda cannot succeed abroad if his Project 2025 agenda fails at home. As his reckless pursuit of total executive power meets roadblocks, his U-turns in foreign policy will be seen as equally reckless and unacceptable. Gertov argues therein lies our hope for a return to democracy and the rule of law at home and abroad. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Donald Trump's embrace of America First represents a dramatic U-turn from the liberal internationalism that Democratic and Republican presidents alike adopted as a foreign policy framework. Free trade and economic globalization, active participation in international organizations, security coalitions, support of human rights and international law, these were standard U.S. positions. National security, in short, was a bipartisan enterprise. Granted, national security has all too often been a justification for interventions abroad, for trampling on human rights, and for engaging in secret operations beyond the reach of Congress. Donald Trump has not, however, based his foreign policy on opposition to those abuses of power. His concern has been that national security too often means costly overseas entanglements. So he has taken foreign policy in a much worse direction, purely self-interested, using American power to persuade or punish those who get in our way without regard to previous commitments, long-standing friendships, the rule of law, or human rights. He operates on a very untraditional cost-benefit calculus, zero sum. His first few months in office made that apparent. His tariff wars, his resetting of relations with Russia, his recasting of Europe and NATO as unwanted obligations, his evisceration of the U.S. Agency for International Development, and his withdrawal of the United States from the World Health Organization and the Paris Accord on Climate Change. In the latest issue of the journal Foreign Affairs, the analyst Hal Brands acknowledges the serious flaws in Trump's America First foreign policy, but suggests that he has the opportunity to use it to serve America and the world. Brands writes that Trump has no interest in international order and does not value alliances. Yet, he writes, Trump intuitively understands something that many liberal internationalists forget. Order flows from power and can hardly be preserved without it. Thus, he writes, if Trump can harness his most constructive impulses, he has a chance to pressure adversaries, coax more out of allies, and reinforce resistance to the Eurasian, that is to say, Russian, Chinese, North Korean, and Iranian assault. But therein lies the problem. What constructive impulses? What flexible diplomacy? Even as this article was being published, Trump was acting in ways contrary to the author's policy ideas. Trump wasn't pressuring the Russians or searching for common ground. He was talking like a Kremlin propagandist. He wasn't coaxing NATO and the European Union. He was badgering them and causing a crisis in relations that will surely spread mistrust of U.S. security commitments in Asia and elsewhere. Trump was also threatening to return to regime change in Iran and a full-out trade war with China. Trump's resort to his most destructive impulses in foreign affairs is only part of the problem. The other part, which Brands barely mentions, is his destructive actions at home. America First cannot succeed abroad if it fails at home. Unless Trump can clean house and get rid of all the sources of opposition in line with the aims of Project 2025, he will not be able to sustain his foreign policy revisionism. My optimism here rests on two beliefs. First, Trump's failures of leadership, his appointments of extraordinarily incompetent people, and Trump's own recklessness and blind ambition. And second, the many efforts we are witnessing to block and overturn his extremist executive orders. Trump and Musk are overreaching, and that will eventually lead to decisive losses at the polls. The more defeats Trump-Musk suffer in the courts from a resistant bureaucracy, in the stock market, in town hall meetings, and in the streets, the more will they be bottled up and flummoxed. Their already absurd foreign policy agenda, acquiring Greenland and Canada, preparing to invade the Panama Canal Zone, engaging in peace talks with Russia, imposing self-destructive tariffs on everyone, trying to deport people without due process, and keep people of color out, will look ever more harmful and impossible to implement. As the tide turns against Trump and Musk, many of his supporters will jump ship. Some Republicans in the Senate, international business leaders, people in the intelligence community, and others who voted for Trump, but who also value stability and predictability in U.S. policymaking. Dictators everywhere believe their power is limitless and their popularity is secure, until it isn't. They typically underestimate the anger they have caused and the commitment of public servants to act in accordance with the rules of law. Both those forces are evident today. Every illegitimate and mindless move by Trump is being challenged. These are like roadblocks that people under siege put up to stop tanks from advancing. And let's face it, we are under siege by a government that is out to destroy democracy within and liberal values without. I'm Mel Gertoff of the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 18, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Anna Wilcox and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Galatas, and Tramel Gomes. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.